Happy birthday, America. It's time to celebrate and play your favorite Las Vegas casino games by American-owned SpinQuest.com. What's better than fireworks and American pie? Hitting a blackjack in the palm of your hand, and you won't lose your fingers. Over 1,000 games, including slots and live dealers, and $30 coin packs are on sale for 10. SpinQuest.com. Buy American players for American players.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Mohdad. We are doing a live episode today on the United States National Security Strategy, which came out last month in November, and which is really a bit of a game changer, shall we say. This is a live episode, so as usual, please leave your questions and comments in the chat. I will be glancing at them as we go, and I will try to explain what is going on with this strategy and why it is very much of a big deal. So let me start by reading a couple of segments from this, because I think that they're really relevant. The piece starts with a diagnosis of what's been wrong with American strategy so far, and I think it's really good. It says, American strategies since the end of the Cold War have fallen short. They have been laundry lists of wishes or desired end states, have not clearly defined what we want, but instead stated vague platitudes, like exporting democracy, making the world safe for democracy, blah, 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 and have often misjudged what we should want. After the end of the Cold War, American foreign policy elites convinced themselves that permanent American domination of the entire world was in the best interests of our country. Yet the affairs of other countries are our concern only if their activities directly threaten our interests. So right at the outset, this is a resetting of what the United States should be doing. It's essentially an admission of the death of two things. It's the death of globalization, and it's the death of foreign policy idealism. That's what's being stated here, that really the concern of the United States should only be about its own interests. And these interests are no longer defined in abstract terms like democratization or liberalism or women's rights or anything of that nature. Rather, they are defined in concrete, hard-nosed ways that focus just on the bottom line and of American interests. That itself is really welcoming. That itself is really a welcome development. It's a big change from how the Americans have been accustomed to think, from how the Americans present the world, presented the world as a war between good and evil. It's really a lot more focused, and it's focused primarily on national interest rather than focusing on big abstract ideas. So again, this is quite good. Another thing that's remarkable about the strategy, I find, which I'm going to talk about a little bit, is the way that it's highly personal. It's all about President Trump and what he wants and what he expects. And this is another welcome change. It's no longer about the assumption that we're the good guys, everybody else is bad, we are in consensus over what good is, and we're going to impose it on the rest of the world. Rather, it's a highly personalized strategy that says that Trump has a vision, and this vision is defined as America first. And that's a phrase that's actually used in the document. And that what is going to be pursued is what is necessary for America now because of the condition that America is in. So we see this big change in thinking, and we see a massive condemnation of the previous order. The document says, our elites badly miscalculated America's willingness to shoulder forever global burdens, to which the American people saw no connection to the national interest. They overestimated America's ability to fund simultaneously a welfare, regulatory, administrative state, alongside a massive military, diplomatic, intelligence, and foreign aid complex. That's exactly right, and that gets to the heart of the problem. The Americas were trying to govern the whole world while maintaining a social democracy at home. And that social democracy was getting increasingly intrusive with an endlessly expansive administrative regulatory state. And this has been seen correctly as a big problem. And the challenge that's in the document that is that the Americans need to prioritize one or the other. And they can't be doing all of these things at the same time. And so you see in this document reflected a lot of ideas around the need for the American economy to be unleashed, which I'm going to get to. And that obviously requires less welfare, less administration, less regulation. But also a very deep-seated necessity, which is to focus America's foreign actions on America's own interests. So in a way, this is what I've described in past pieces on my website, Madad Geopolitics. This is imperial consolidation. They need to get rid of some of the responsibilities that they have already. They need to get rid of some of the internal hindrances that they've been facing that have prevented them from growing at anything more than a sclerotic rate of, 2%, 3%. Obviously, if you're in Europe, you're begging for 2% growth. But for the Americans, this is too low, and 4% makes a huge difference versus 3% because of the additional spending that it allows on military and on intelligence and so on that keeps the Americans ahead of China. So these small changes in percentage growth actually make a big difference when you have a multi-trillion dollar economy. And you see this need to rationalize the empire, to trim down the commitments, and to trim down the obstacles to growth domestically. So this is quite important. The document continues, they placed hugely misguided and destructive bets on globalism and on so-called free trade that hollowed out the very middle class and industrial base on which American economic and military preeminence depend. Pretty strong language. Huge condemnation of free trade. And obviously with big implications for China, for Europe, for the rest of the world, given that they have benefited from trading with the United States, arguably far more than the Americans themselves have benefited. They allowed allies and partners to offload the cost of their defense onto the American people and sometimes to suck us into conflicts and controversies central to their interests, but peripheral or irrelevant to ours. Now, I can think of the Russia-Ukraine war as fitting that description, but I also can think of the various Middle Eastern wars over the last two decades that also very closely fit that description. And they lashed American policy to a network of international institutions, some of which are driven by outright anti-Americanism, and many by a transnationalism that explicitly seeks to dissolve individual state sovereignty. Pretty strong stuff. Let's see if it actually carries through and does what it's supposed to. The document then goes on to explain what do the Americans want from the world. This is a pretty lengthy segment, and I'll try to go over it. What we want is continued survival and safety of the United States as an independent sovereign republic whose government secures the God-given natural rights of its citizens and prioritizes their well-being and interests. So this is a very American understanding of the world. God gives us natural rights, which is true. Obviously, God does give us these rights. And the role of the government is to safeguard these rights. But the word survival is interesting, because the word survival betrays a lack of confidence. If you were an American in the 80s, outside of nuclear war, you wouldn't be thinking about survival. You certainly wouldn't be thinking about survival in the 90s or the 2000s. So there's a change in thinking that's reflected in that small word here. We want to protect this country, its people, its territory, etc., etc. We want full control of our borders, over our immigration system. Resilient national infrastructure that can withstand disasters. World's most lethal military, etc. So it sort of shows that the priority here is a little bit reactive. And that is a welcome change. Because the idealism had led to such a disastrous situation in the United States and in the world when it comes to questions of trade and when it comes to questions of migration, that now a reactive approach is necessary. Now, when it comes to what do they want to do, they explain, the authors of this document explain, we want to ensure that the Western Hemisphere remains reasonably stable and well-governed enough to prevent and discourage mass migration to the United States. Top priority, mass migration. And what is required here? Reasonably stable and well-governed. So no idealism. No specific formula as to how Argentina should be run or Mexico should be run. But priorities about immigration and therefore the flow of people and the consequences of that. We want a hemisphere whose governments cooperate with us against narco-terrorists, cartels, and other transnational criminal organizations. And we want a hemisphere that remains free of hostile foreign incursion or ownership of key assets, and that supports critical supply chains. So the first thing that you see in this is what the Americans call, or is what the authors of this document call, the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. So I think we were talking about this last week, and we covered what the Americans are doing in the world and how this is changing on a daily podcast, me and Dan and Nate. And one of the things that we said was that the Americans really desperately need to control the Western Hemisphere. And now they are approaching this from a defensive position, from a position where they need to have enough influence to stop Latin America from actively harming the United States by focusing on immigration, drugs, and rival and geopolitical rivals, that is China. Obviously, the only country with a decent presence in the Western Hemisphere that is potentially a threat to the United States is China. And they view this as an update and revitalization of the Monroe Doctrine with what they are labeling the Trump corollary. And typically, these kinds of strategies don't focus that much on the president and on emphasizing the role of the president. They try to present themselves as working for, you know, the general will of the American people. So what's sort of reflected here in the emphasis on Trump is something of the personalization of politics, which extends into the way he uses friends and family to execute foreign policy. So the negotiations with Russia are being done by his real estate buddy, Steve Witkoff. The negotiations over the Middle East are being done by Tom Barak, another real estate buddy. Jared Kushner is involved in everything. So this emphasis on the person of Trump is also a little bit strange. The second thing that they mention, we want to halt and reverse the ongoing damage that foreign actors inflict on the American economy, that's China, while keeping the Indo-Pacific free and open, preserving freedom of navigation in all crucial sea lanes, that's Taiwan, and maintaining secure and reliable supply chains and access to critical materials. This is about developing alternative supply chains to China so that China cannot impose sanctions on the United States, which, as the Americans found out in the trade war this year, they're not really in a great position to fight. So the first priority is the Western Hemisphere. The second priority is China. Then it says we want to support our allies in preserving the freedom and security of Europe while restoring Europe's civilizational self-confidence and Western identity. Now, Europe gets quite a beating in this document, and I'm going to go through that. But this is a really important point here. The American view of Europe is that either it has fallen or it is at risk of falling. And when that happens, it will damage the Americans, because one of their biggest trading partners and their most natural ally would have fallen into chaos or under Islamic influence or worse, you know? And then they say, we want to prevent an adversarial power from dominating the Middle East, its oil and gas supplies and the choke points through which they pass, while avoiding the forever wars that bogged us down in the region. So for the Middle East, it's not about doing whatever it takes for Israel anymore. It is about maintaining a balance of power between Iran and Turkey and Israel and the Arab states to further the interests of the United States. So this is a big change in thinking here. Under, say, pre-1992 American administrations, there was emphasis on maintaining some kind of balance in the Middle East between Israel and its neighbors slash enemies. This pretty much went, starting with Clinton, escalating with Bush through Obama and Biden and Trump. Now there's a change in language here. The change in language says that in the Middle East, all we want is a balance of power and the ability to continue pumping oil. And implicitly, anything that threatens that balance of power and the ability to supply energy markets, we don't approve of it. And implicitly, that includes Israel. They've written this. We'll see if they follow through with it. Then they talk about what assets do they have to actually achieve the strategy. And the first one is a nimble political system that can correct course. That one is questionable. The American system lends itself to paralysis. And the fact that there is an electoral cycle every 2 years endlessly traps the United States in campaigning mode. And if you're constantly in campaigning mode, you are not in execution mode. You're promising things instead of doing things. And that comes with a price. So it's not clear to me that the Americans have this kind of nimble political system. More importantly, what we've seen in the past is Congress trying to paralyze American presidents that wanted to do things that they didn't approve of. So when Obama's policy was to try to get out of the Middle East by making a deal with Iran to make sure that it didn't develop nuclear weapons, faulty as the deal was, Congress paralyzed him and imposed new sanctions on the Iranians that meant that the 2015 Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action could never actually be implemented. With Russia, we'll probably see Congress trying to impose sanctions on the Russians that are intended to tie Trump's hands and to prevent him from executing what he says he wants in this document, which is to end the Ukraine war, etc., etc. So I'm not convinced here. Then they argue that they have the single largest and most innovative economy. They don't have the largest economy. On a purchasing power parity basis, and to translate that, you can count GDP or gross domestic product, that is the sum total of what your economy has produced in a year, in two ways. One way is that you count the dollar value of everything that is produced. Another way is to count how much that which has been produced actually purchases. So for instance, if you want to stay in a hotel in New York, you'll probably pay $400 a night, $500 a night. If you want to stay somewhere, you know, in rural New Jersey, you might pay $200. So what's counted here is number of hotel rooms, not the value. And if you measure the economy this way, the Chinese economy is 25% bigger than the American economy, according to the World Bank and to the IMF, who, there's a lot of criticism towards them. They know how to count this kind of stuff, and they know how to measure it. So this gets a little bit delusional. The third strength that they identify is the dollar's global reserve currency status. That's a half-truth. What the sanctions regimes against Iran and Russia and China have shown is that actually the dollar's importance has really declined, because everybody can now bypass the American dollar and find ways of transacting that don't involve it. The world's most powerful and capable military. I'm going to get to that in a second. Broad network of alliances with treaty allies and so on. Well, the alliances are the problem. So the Americans are looking at their assets and they're counting, you know, political system, not true. Largest economy, not true. Global reserve currency status, half truth. Best technology sector, I have some questions mark around that, because American technology tends to get you to doom scroll on Facebook or YouTube or whatever, rather than getting you to sort of do productive things. And Chinese AI is just as good as American AI. Most capable military, big question mark. Broad network of alliances, they're the burden. And then they say the geography of the United States, because they have an ocean on each side and friendly neighbors. Okay, another half-truth, etc. So there's a little bit of a problem on the asset sides of things that this document presents. But we can get past that and get to the properly meaty stuff about what they're going to be doing in different regions in a couple of minutes. Now, when it comes to the principles that they have this in this strategy, the first one is focused definition of national interest. What we already said. They're only going to think about whether or not this is good for America in their assessment. They're not going to think about anything else. That's positive. Peace through strength, deterrence. Pretty good. Predisposition to non-interventionism. Now, that's a particularly important point here. Because what the Americans are saying is, unless it's definitely in our national interest, we are going to let wars get fought out wherever they happen, and we are going to ignore what is happening in the rest of the world. At least, to be fair to the document, at least they will not be intervening directly. Rather, what they say is that they will achieve peace through strength by using their diplomatic influence to end wars, which is something that Donald Trump is very proud of doing. And then the rest of it is primacy of nations. So that's a big no-no to the EU. Sovereignty and respect, another no-no to the EU. Balance of power, meaning that they won't allow any single regional power to become too dominant in its region. It's a bit too late when it comes to China. Pro-American worker, pro-fairness, and competence and merit. And there's a rant against DEI and how DEI has been paralyzing the American economy because it's anti-competitive and bad for American institutions and is holding them back. And that's absolutely true. One of the big issues with the attempts to build up new chip plants in Arizona has been the DEI regulations that were imposed by the Biden administration, which pretty much paralyzed the project. Now, when it comes to their priorities, the first priority is mass migration. That's it. We don't want to have any more mass immigration into the United States. That's pretty good. And they go into that at some length and explaining that it is, you know, demographic change is destiny. Like demographics is destiny. This is not a controversial idea. They've been talking about this for a while, and slowly the right has been winning the argument on these kinds of questions. So I think that that really matters. And they go on a long rant here, who a country admits into its...
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10. at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.